this Him I Map feature that you were using as a, were you using as an observation post?
Oh, not up on it. We were round it, because it seemed to be growing like a mountain out of the desert.
Yes.
And isolated, but it was a feature, and that was sort of our centre from there, that area, all around it where we did our patrols. It was a good landmark, and as I say, it stood out so obviously, and in fact, that's the way they eventually came in. By Hemima when they attacked.
How high was it? Have you any idea of its
of how many feet? I would say, I don't know how high the Rigging is there, it was about that height, but not so wide at the base. It's I'd say a couple of thousand feet, would that be high? I have no idea.
It's very substantial.
Oh, yes. Oh, you could see it from a long way off.
Yes.
You know.
Was it pure rock or what?
Or sand, or rock sand, that sort of thing. But we never climbed it at all. We were always just around the base of it and in that area of Hemima. So I don't know whether the gunners ever went up there and used it as an observation post. I don't think so. They did somehow. They might have done it. It might come out in another one of your things. You might find out. But I can't recall any gunners going up there. Although there were, I think the 60th Rifles were in that area as well, all down around there. And just around about that time, we got a new commanding officer come in.
What happened to that? Was he to replace the
colonel who'd
been captured?
Yes, right, yeah. Of course, William Brown Clayton and Sammy Strang, that was the other one who was second in command, the New Zealander. He, they weren't the ones who were due to command anyway. And we got in Colonel George Kidston.
Where did he come from?
He was an old 12th Lancer. He was a 12th Lancer before the war. And I knew him as a lieutenant. And he'd come, he'd been second in command of the CLY, Captain London Yeomanry. It had been commanded by Frank Arkwright, who again was an old 12th Lancer. And he was my squadron leader when I first joined. And he was commanding the County London Yeomanry, but he was killed at Knightsbridge, and George Kidston had sort of taken over command, and I think that he'd been wounded as well, but eventually he turned up to command our regiment, and he was very popular and very good officer. I can tell you a story about him with Montgomery. I know you'd like me to tell it now. I was up near Tripoli Way, I think, after the Battle of Alamy, and George had a TAC HQ, sort of a tent type thing, a couple of jeeps and an armoured car and whatnot. And he was in his TAC HQ one day, and Monty walked in. He drove up in his jeep, and George Kidston was eating an egg. So he said, said to George, "Where do you get the eggs from?" So George didn't say, "Oh, my driver gets them." So he said, "Well, where do you get them from?" He said, "Well, he goes out to the Bedouins and he changes tea for eggs." So Monty said, "Yeah, but we don't get enough tea. The ration is so small, we haven't got enough to, you know, do that." So George said, "Well, my driver, Nobby Simmons, as far as the Cockney real character, what he does, when we have tea, he dries it out in the sun, see, and then when he's got a fair amount dried, he mixes a little bit of good tea with it, and then he goes out and he gets these Bedouins and he does a swap, eggs for tea. So Monty said, gosh, that's a good idea, you see. And this George Kidston told me this himself. And he said, that's a good idea. So obviously George Kidston, Monty went back to his HQ and obviously told his driver what to do, you see. And about 3 or 4 days later, he stormed into George Kidson's TAC HQ again, you see. He said, George, he said, you put me in a most embarrassing position. He said, my driver did what your driver did. He said, and next day there were hordes of Bedouins screaming all around the area, you know, filthy British and all this sort of thing. Why is it you get away with it and me, the army commander, get caught out? And George said, well, it's simply, General. It's quite simple what I do. He said, when my driver's done it, I move my headquarters. And old George told me this himself, so I knew it was true.
You haven't mentioned the Bedouin before. Did you have any contact with them?
Not before, no. You probably might see the odd camel or so right in the distance or something, but you never had any dealings with them at that stage. I think it was after Alamein we started seeing them and sort of dealing with them a bit. Because I think we were up then more in the civilised areas.
You were saying that the enemy main push when you came through the Himalayan area, were you out on patrol when that started?
Yes,
developed?
Yes.
What did you see first as this attack formed?
Well, as it happened, it was... and just before this happened, Montgomery appeared.
Had you seen him before?
No, he turned up at B Squadron, and I can see him now. I think he had shorts on. And he appeared in the squadron leaguer, Stuka raid came down. I can see him now running like mad, getting into one of the armoured cars. You know, and that was his greeting to B Squadron when, and he was coming around to see the different regiments, I think, ready, you know, taking over.
Did he address the squadron?
No. Well, he couldn't, you see, in that area, in the forward area, and that would have been fatal to have got everybody together for that.
Were you out on patrol then?
No, we were in a leaguer at the time. Open leaguer.
Out in the desert?
In the desert, yeah. In more or less in our positions, but in an open leaguer position.
Just before the defence line, out of way.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So he'd come beyond his own.
That's right,
defense
yeah,
line to see it.
Yeah. And...
had you seen any senior officers before Montgomery's visit? Have you ever seen
Orkin
Lake, for example?
No, but I'd seen... a number of others. I'd seen most of the divisional commanders and the corps commanders and that, but the army commander we hadn't seen.
Seen an army commander with
no, him. No. And, but to say, Horrocks we saw, and divisional commanders, and Gott, who was due to take over the 8th Army. Stratford Gott. He's the one we were escorting when we were shot at.
Yes.
So we met him and Jock Campbell, VC, we'd met him. You know, so those people we'd met.
So Montgomery had a rather lively time when he
was in the squadron. Yeah, I think you'd remember that. Yeah. But we were expecting a full-scale attack by that time. And that was around about the end of August. And there was a full moon. And the squadrons were up in the position around near Hamina. And there was a belt of minefields ahead of the main Alamein line. And we were to the south, right to the southern end of it.
Yeah.
And that's where we were in positions. And at night as well, we didn't come back to Leaguer at night. We had to stay up that time, because we were expecting the push then, so we were in positions at night of observation, or listening more than anything.
What sort of things did you hear?
Well, it was on the night of the 30th of August, and it was a full moon. I remember the night so clear, it was beautiful, a full moon, and of course the sand and everything, it looked so good and still, and everyone was very quiet and sort of listening to see if they could hear any slight of sound. And I think around about midnight, three troop reported some movement in his area, as he could hear the engineers, German engineers, clearing a gap through the minefield.
How far away was that from
him? I suppose 1,000 yards, perhaps, or might have been a bit more, because in the moonlight you could probably see a fair way, but the sound was travelling more than the.
Were you up in the picket line on this night, or were you back at
Squadron Headquarters? We were all together, more or less. The troops were sort of
in line,
and I was with the squadron leader. Mm. We were in a little hollow type thing, like a sand dune that side and sand dune that, and we were in between that. Mm. And ran along, and the three armoured cars of HQ were in there. And the troops were probably 1,000 yards ahead of us. You know,
so you were behind the three.
That's right.
They were doing the observing. You were
we were listening and reporting back to. They reported to squadron headquarters, and then that went on to either brigade or division, to commanding officer, and then on to division and or brigade or division, whatever we were. Under the time, yeah. And so this sound came, and then slowly through the minefields came the tanks. And old Dickie Hesler, who was commanding, I think, 3 Troop, could see them as plain, sort of within 1,000 yards, seeing this lot coming through. You see, so we all sort of kept in line with them, you know, sort of observing.
Pulling back,
yeah. But it'd be pointless to have stayed where we were, because we would have been then cut off.
Outside.
Yeah, so we kept in and started reporting back. And you could hear then the noise of the tanks rattling and the engines roaring. And by the morning, you could see quite a lot of equipment coming. And that was the start, actually, of the first battle of Alamein, which Rommel was hoping to bash through. And if that had succeeded, he'd have been in Egypt. And he'd been in Cairo in 24 hours, I think. So. And by dawn, as I say, you could see the full strength of the tank force and all the supporting vehicles. And they'd penetrated the southern flank and were going on to Gabala, where the dummy brigade was. And they were heading that direction. And that was with 3 Africa Corps Division. 21st
Panzer,
90 Light, and what was the other one?
15th Panzer.
That's right. Yeah, the three. They were all together, and to the north of them was the Australians, and an Indian division, and they were being attacked by the Italian army. So the thing was the Germans were swinging round to the south. Hoping to swinging round to get behind the Australians and the Indians while the Italians were doing the frontal attack on them to the north. And the New Zealand Division, 4th Armoured Brigade and 7th Infantry Brigade, were striking at the flanks of the panzers. See, so we were leading them, and I think it was Auchinleck was still in charge then, was dictating where the battle would take place. So they obviously dropped back, and they were hitting the Germans from the flank.
You were fading back through them as they came.
That's
forward.
Right. Yeah. Well, now we were still to the south of them.
Yes, I see. So you they see, were attacking from the north.
Yeah, they were coming from the north, and they were hitting the flanks
of the German
of the German column. Mm-hmm.
Seems rather peculiar that we didn't hit them with artillery as they were trying to clear the minefield.
Yeah, they didn't actually. I think they were waiting. It might have been a little bit too far ahead from where the main artillery were. The artillery weren't mobile. Mm-hmm. I think they were in their set places, and I think the thing was to allow them to come there, and in order to pick their own ground,
to catch them
on as where we want to fight, not where he wanted to fight. So I think that probably they let them come through. And as they were being reported coming along, and eventually they would come in on the flank. So, we were withdrawing according to what the speed of the enemy were. You know, just keeping and reporting. That was all we had to do. And then just about that time we had a sandstorm, and that made it a bit more difficult and more dangerous to. We were coming and dropping back, and there was the Ragged Wadi, which was you came in off the desert. That was like going into a tunnel, quite wide, a wide area, and that was where we were leading the Germans into. That's where they were making for. I don't think we were. We weren't actually luring them into it. That's the way they were going, and that's where we were. We were going back that way and reporting. You see. Mm. But that was the. That's where they were going up the Ragged Wadi. So, which was great for them. You know. A good thing for them to go to, really, as far as we were concerned. And just before we got into the Ragged Wadi, our troops were in front, and you could see the tanks by then all coming, and we were dropping back. And you know, not fast, just, you know, a bit at a time. You know,
I was going to ask what sort of speed.
Not fast. Leisurely pace, and we'd be able to stop for a while. And watch them, and then they'd come on a bit more. They weren't coming blind, you know. I think they were being very cautious about the way. That's right. And
how were they laid out? What sort of formation were they in?
Just a mass, really. You know, they were like rather like our tanks. When they were advanced, you'd see about a dozen tanks or 20 tanks in a line. I don't know what was behind them. All you'd see would be the main
first line
sort of coming along. They might have been arrowhead formation or what. All you would see, looking at it, you'd see a tank and another tank to the side. Now, there might have been 100 yards back or that, but you couldn't tell from the distance we were away. All you would see was the thing. And they were shelling as well, you see, as they were coming forward.
Were they shelling you or any
Yes, our area and our people. And because I know when we were at the mouth of the Ragged Wadi, a couple of shells came by me, and they skimmed the ground and took out great furrows. And I think that was an 88 overshot.
Yeah.
And but you could still hear the thing and the speed and the whine of it. Cause it was and then we got a call just there where the troop, truancy troop, were running out of petrol. And of course we couldn't send a lorry up that area or anything, because it was under fire. So I got a Jeep, and I put in on the back a load of jerry cans, sort of stacked them in there, and I just took the driver and myself, and I took enough petrol, you know, to give them about 9 gallon each. Yeah, 2 jerry cans each, I suppose. And drove up behind each troop, each armoured car. And, you know, petrol threw up on the back for them, and then got back as fast as I could. And
how long would that keep them going for?
Oh, that would see them through for the day.
It would.
Yeah. And certainly until the speed they were dropping back, that certainly keep them going till they got into safety, so they could fill right. I can't remember how much they used to hold. I mean, the tank used to hold about 200 gallon or something, but I'm not sure how much the armoured car did. But anyway, it wasn't sufficient any to keep them going. That's the main thing.
These German tanks, I mean, were they the first German vehicles, or did they have any sort of recce ahead of them?
Didn't see any recce. It seems the tanks were coming because they were the heavier. They could wipe out any forward position or opposition, whereas an armoured car wouldn't be able to. So I think they were using their main heavier stuff to eliminate any infantry position. And
was this German advance covered by air support at all?
No, I didn't see any air.
No,
I think, of course. I think by then we had air superiority. We were so close to our own bases, which were just down the road, really. On that, there was a big air base on the Cairo to Alexander Road, you see, which was really virtually what 50 mile away, less than that. So,
what sort of intervals were there between the German tanks? Could you tell, you know, what distances they were keeping?
Say, looking at them, he would say, right, there's one tank there.
Yeah.
And then if you sort of took a guess, a couple of hundred yards perhaps, or something, you know.
So
they're still quite, they looked a formidable force. Mm-hmm. And from 1,000 yards, say, three tanks look fairly close together.
Yes.
You see, so I should imagine they would operational would be about at least 200 yards apart.
Could you tell if they've got any infantry out?
No, no, no. But I should say they would probably have had their infantry in carriers fairly close behind. They always used to work like that. And probably engineers with them as well, in case they met up with any obstacle that wanted clearing.
Well, they must have had engineers to lift the mine.
That's right, they'd done that. See, I think what they'd done, they'd made a track through the minefield, which everyone would come through. It was probably wide enough to take tanks, say, 3 or 4 abreast.
Yes.
And that sort of thing. And, they looked quite a big force coming down anyway. And of course they would have their 88s with them as well. By then we were at the western end of the Magal Wadi, dropping back towards the enemy line, the Alamein 9.
Was this wadi open at both ends?
It sort of rose up,
yes,
and came up, and either side up was like a big. You imagine a river bank. And then the base on was a mile across, it might have been that, might have been less, but something like that, with a bank either side. And that's where the Germans were going, and then that sort of sloped out at the end into flat ground. But I thought it was a good killing ground, actually.
So they were following you down the wadi,
or they were going there, and we were dropping back to it. And some Stukas flew overhead, and of course they weren't attacking us, they were going for the infantry,
yes,
their positions. So So that was about 18 stupas came over about that same time. But they weren't sort of having the same success as they had at Knightsbridge. I think they were started to make... the way the defence line and the positions of the British had sort of forced the Germans to go a different direction than they would like to have gone. And then at the same time as they were in this Ragged Wadi, we started getting the Boston bombers come over. And I think it was 9 at a time used to come over. Quite high. And they were coming over every half an hour. 9 Boston bombers. And they'd drop the bombs, and you'd see them come over, drop the bombs, circle around, back again. Half an hour later, probably less than that, another 9 would come. And so it kept on, this continuous bombing
of the Wadi,
where the German troops were. And they really took a pounding, they really did. And certainly slowed them down.
Did you notice any fire from them?
Oh, yes. Oh, you mean them firing?
At the bombers, yes.
I think some of the 88 millimetres, because they were
anti-aircraft.
They might have, but they were dropped. They were quite high, so I never saw any of them shot down. But as I say, they certainly were pounding the enemy, and by then the armoured divisions were taking an interest in sort of shooting up, and so the Germans lost a tremendous number of tanks then. And on the 3rd and 4th, on the night of the 3rd and 4th of September, the enemy withdrew. And that was their first sort of time that they'd really been forced back, and they lost quite a large number of tanks, and the Wadi was littered with equipment, lorries, tanks, petrol lorries, these huge caravan type things. Of massive equipment was in that Wadi that had been destroyed by either the armoured division or the Boston bombers.
Did you see our armoured divisions going in on their
camp? No.
Had you been withdrawn out of the way?
Well, we were well out of the way, and I think they hit their flank.
Yes.
You see, so we were further out of the way of them, and because it seems as though that the enemy came along in this direction, and the salt Qatar depression was there, so that they couldn't go that way at all.
No.
And they filed in the Ragged Wadi like there.
Yes.
You see, and the divisions were, they were forward then of the main Alamein line. Mm. They hadn't got to there by then.
They didn't assault our infantry position.
No. There was sort of along here where they were all being.
So they were hit from the air, and then they were counterattacked
by the tanks. Mm. And that was the first defeat Rommel had suffered.
And they then fell back.
He then fell back.
Did you follow them up?
No. There was not much point, really. The whole area was littered with guns, tanks, trucks, equipment. And I think that was the turning point in the battle for Egypt,